From Hologram Radio, this is Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is the author of History of Wolves, a novel that was shortlisted for the 2017 Man Booker Prize, and, as Kirkus puts it, has a tinge of fairy tale, wavering on the blur between good and evil, thought and action, but the sharp consequences for its characters make it singe and sing, a literary tour de force. Her fiction has appeared in Boston Review, Southwestern Review, Five Chapters, New Orleans Review, Southwester, and the Portland Review, among other journals. And I am thrilled to have Emily Fridland on the show. Emily, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So your book, History of Wolves, is set in Minnesota, and it bounces between several different time periods. I believe the 90s and then present time. And Minnesota, you're from Minnesota, and the backwoods of Minnesota, of northern Minnesota, plays an integral part to the story. It's practically its own character. And I was wondering if you could talk about your upbringing in Minnesota and how that influenced the setting.
Sure. The first thing to say is I am not Linda. So I actually grew up in the Twin Cities in a suburb of Minneapolis. So I'm from the city, not from the backwoods like Linda is. But I did grow up going up north with my family in the summers for camping trips, and especially visiting the North Shore of Lake Superior. And so that place always held a sort of special spot in my imagination. I actually wrote the first part of the book when I was living in Los Angeles, of all places, and found myself, missing winter, which is hard for me to imagine now. I live in upstate New York and don't miss winter as much as I did when I lived in LA. But so I found myself imaginatively going back to this place, this part of the world that I had visited when I was younger. And then I moved around a lot. As the novel evolved, I lived on the East Coast, in upstate New York, in LA. And I almost feel like the more I moved and the farther I got from Minnesota, the more important Minnesota became in the book. And the tighter the circles that I drew around a very sort of small place, I found myself focusing on just a few lakes and this little town that I invented called Loose River, and a few roads and highways that became Linda's universe, really. So in a lot of ways, the book, it comes from memory, my memory of being up north as a kid. It comes from some research that I did. I went back to northern Minnesota while I was writing, and I also did a lot of reading of some fabulous nature writers from that region. But I also think it's important to say it's an invented place as well. Mm-hmm. There is no Loose River, Minnesota. I needed to have sort of the mental space to invent and to make things up. And so much of the setting is about revealing Linda as a character. The character and the place are intricately connected throughout the book.
You said that you had grown up going camping in the woods and everything. And there's a part towards the end of the book where Linda talks about the woods. She's moved out of Loose River, and she's living in I want to say she's in the Twin Cities.
She is, exactly.
And she says something along the lines of when I go back, the woods are not the same as when I remember them, or as they were from my childhood. They're not the same woods. When you went back during the writing of this book, did you experience the same kind of thing? They weren't the same as you had remembered them as a child?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I was very interested in when I was writing this book is the way memory changes things, and also how nothing stays the same. And so, there's this tendency, I think, for all of us to romanticize wilderness and to romanticize wild places. There's a tendency, I think, in Linda to do that about her home when she leaves it. But no, of course, the place never stays the same. It can never be the place that you remember when you were a child. I appreciate that passage that you brought up. There's another one that kind of chimes with that. It's a little piece of a letter that Mr. Grierson, Linda's history teacher, writes. And he talks about going to Yosemite when he was a kid, essentially, you know, not wanting to go back because he doesn't want to ruin the place that he remembered from when he was a child. There is something about that jarring disjuncture between how something feels when you're a kid and how you remember it, and what actually is there, and how it not only has changed, but perhaps you always had it wrong. You know, perhaps you were always fictionalizing to some extent.
It's interesting you bring up the concept of memory, because time is such a central part of this book. The whole book almost takes on a surreal feeling, like we're walking through Linda's memories as she's mm-hmm. telling us these things. She bounces between her childhood, teenagehood, adulthood, the trial. Mm-hmm. And I would think a narrative structure like that would be jarring, but it's almost like watching a Quentin Tarantino film. Like you always know where you are, and it's never so jarring as it pulls you out of it. If anything, it's interesting to get the perspective of her as a child and then bring it back to her as an adult. And I was wondering if you could tell me about how you came to develop this structure of bouncing between the different parts of her life to bring one cohesive story together.
Yeah, I mean, I love thinking about plot and timing and when to release information to the reader. And those sorts of questions are really fun. I kind of think of them as kind of the math of the book, right? You know, when how long to linger in a scene and when to move to something very different and when to go back. And if you're not telling a story chronologically, I think a lot of those questions become more interesting and kind of frees one up as a writer. And that's how I felt once I decided not to tell the story chronologically. It's also harder to write in a way, right? Because you have to think hard about those transitions. I wanted to make them feel like kind of the natural movements of a mind, especially a mind that's been marked by trauma and is kind of constantly circling back to a few important events, but also in a way unable to entirely hone in on those events because of the pain associated with them. So I was thinking a lot about how to do that, how to give that sense. I decided early on to reveal an important event, the death of a character in the first couple pages, in part because I felt like that was the reason that Linda is telling the story, and I wanted to make that reason clear. And then about halfway through the book, I actually say not just that this character dies, but how he dies. And that opened the way for the second section of the book. The book is broken into two sections, science and health. Because once I said that this event happened and then how it happened, I was able to think about a lot of other really interesting questions, like why it did and, you know, what are the consequences of that on the people around the event or who participated in the event. And those kinds of larger sort of existential questions were, and moral questions were as interesting to me as the dramatic ones.
You mentioned death, and death is such a big part of Linda's life, especially early on. And yet when she looks at death and when she talks about death, it almost seems like a curiosity to her. She's very much on the outside, even when she's right in front of it. There's a character early on, and I'm not spoiling anything because we I don't think ever hear about this character again, mm-hmm. but her eighth grade history teacher, Mr. Adler, who basically dies in the classroom, and the Boy Scouts are sitting around figuring out who's going to do CPR on him. But the way she talks about it, it's very much as if it's happening almost like on television, like she's watching something happen to someone else and she's not immediately a part of it. And she does that a couple of times, even when she talks about the central character who eventually passes. It's just, she's a very detached person from that. Mm. What was it like writing from Linda's point of view, you know, without that empathy?
Mm. I actually do think of her as somebody who has the capacity for empathy, actually, interestingly enough. But I think your point is a really good one. That opening scene with Mr. Adler is really the scene that got the book started. And in a lot of ways, I actually think of that. So Linda witnesses two deaths over the course of the book. And I was thinking a lot about the relationship of witness to responsibility. What are we held responsible for when we just observe? And should we be held responsible for the things that we see? And that first death, actually, she's the only one in the classroom who approaches this man who's dying of a heart attack and takes his hand. And so though she's unable to do anything to save him, I mean, he's having a heart attack. I actually see that moment as potentially a contrast to the later death that she observes. The first one with Mr. Adler, it's almost as if she's willing to see the death and not be afraid of it the way that many of the other characters, you know, the Boy Scouts and the other teachers are scared and they're kind of repulsed by this person who's dying in front of them. But because of something unusual in Linda, her loneliness, her ability to observe really keenly, she goes and takes this man's hand and is just sort of there while he dies, sort of almost like a ministering angel in a sense. She's just there holding his hand. That's contrasted, I think, quite profoundly with what happens later, in which she observes the death of somebody, but almost refuses to see it. You know, she doesn't stay, she leaves, mm-hmm. She doesn't help when she could potentially. There's this sort of moral failing in the second part of the book, potentially on the part of Linda, not because she's observing and not doing anything, because often we can't do anything when the death is right there in front of us, but because she almost refuses to see it happening in front of her. In the beginning of the book, she doesn't see it because she's young and naive, but increasingly, I think she sees it and sort of looks away because it's not convenient, because she wants to remain part of the little world that she has found for herself. And so, yeah, I was thinking a lot about, the observation of death and even the observation of things we can't control, but what does it mean to observe and not see? Or refuse to see.
It's so interesting, and I know it's you're the author, so it's like what in my mind what you say is how it is. And as I'm reading the book, I got a different sense of her. I do agree she does have the capacity for empathy, but at the same time, like towards the end of the book when she's getting the Tylenol and she has the Tylenol and yet she's meandering to get it back to the person who needs it, and she doesn't get back in time. Like she has the capacity for empathy after the fact, but not in the midst of it. And like you said, she's sort of looking at it. She's observing this thing happening, and she wants to not be as much of a part of it as she inevitably will be. But at the same time, what I really found interesting about Linda was her voice, because like you said, she's this naive kid in the beginning, and yet her voice doesn't really change throughout the book. She is the same Linda. I mean, her experience has changed, but her voice, her vocabulary, the way she talks about things is very much the same throughout the book. And it made me wonder, is she extremely immature throughout her entire life to the point where she didn't really mature into adulthood? Or has she really been the most mature out of everybody around her and never really needed to grow beyond that because she was already well above the people she surrounded herself with?
Oh, that's such a fascinating way of putting it. Yeah, you know, I've always been really interested in the adolescent or teenage narrator. And I think part of the reason I have been is for the reasons that you're describing. There's something incredibly canny about Linda, and not just because she's a teenager, but in part because of her strange background. She was born into this Back to the Land style commune and has kind of raised herself in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the only time I remember her acting like a child is when she's talking about her friend who grew up with her in the commune before they all went away.
Yeah, exactly. There's something about the breaking up of the commune that forces her to grow up, I think, at a really young age.
Yeah.
Potentially. Yeah, and so she's you know, her isolation also means she's incredibly independent. Long before lots of children should be asked to be independent. And that also her independence, her isolation make for this really sort of keen observer. She watches everything really intensely. And that's what makes it possible for her to tell the story, right? To see, she often sees things in other people that others aren't able to see. And kind of calls them on it occasionally, like with Mr. Grierson or with Leo Gardner, the father figure in the book and the family. So yeah, she's incredibly canny in one sense. But at the same time, you're right, she's incredibly naive for the very same reasons, because of her isolation and because of her sort of lack of human contact in a lot of senses.
Right.
She's also, you know, kind of naive, kind of an alien figure in her world. And maybe even to the reader a little bit. I had one reader say she had this sort of alien voice. And I think that's true, that there's a way in which she watches everything and sees how weird even the most ordinary things might be.
Right. Like she's just come to Earth and she's observing humanity for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. But it's because of that she's also unable to see what is truly extraordinary in her life. You know, everything is kind of equally strange and equally ordinary to her. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? If that makes sense. So when terrible, extraordinary things happen, she doesn't allow herself to see them as extraordinary for a long time, in part because so much of her encounters with, you know, with this little family that she's babysitting for, so much of that is new to her. So much of that world is new to her. She has a hard time picking out what stands out about them, what's different about them.
Right.
But yeah, I think your point also is really good about her as an adult. I think it's, you know, totally possible that she doesn't change that much over the course of the book. That canniness that she has as a child, she maintains, but she also doesn't necessarily take, because of the trauma of the events that she witnessed, because of her own sorrow and her sort of isolation and sadness mm-hmm. and frustration, she doesn't have a progress narrative the way that we often expect characters to have in a book.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nocht Sound Engineering. Nocht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nocht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nocht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nocht Sound Engineering today at nochtsound.com. That's nachtsound.com. Nocht, more than a stack of tracks. Right. And you, I guess you could argue that guilt is also a huge part of her upbringing. Not just, I mean, there's her guilt in what happened to that character, but also the guilt about, for example, her ex-history teacher wanting to molest a student and mm-hmm. still ends up going to jail for child pornography, but he mm-hmm. apparently didn't actually touch the girl. But he expresses the guilt as well. I mean, guilt is riddled throughout. Mm-hmm. And her mother also seems to, she does this thing where she keeps trying to dig for the inner child inside her daughter. She keeps trying to like pull it out of her with crafts and the way she talks to her. And mm-hmm. I feel like there's a guilt there for what happened when she was very young with the commune and then everybody leaving, like her childhood being ripped away from her.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. I think you're right. Guilt is a big theme in this book. And in particular, the guilt of that people in positions of authority feel, when thinking about how they have treated or dealt with more vulnerable people, children in particular, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think her mom Linda's mom, or the person she thinks is her mom, or most likely is her mom, but may not be. She had these well-intentioned beliefs. She went to the North Woods with a group of people and wanted to create a system that was better than the nuclear family that she grew up in, her mother grew up in. And, you know, that hippie generation had such high ideals. Those very high ideals didn't make the lives of the children that they were caring for better necessarily. In fact, they might have made them worse. Mm-hmm. And so Linda's growing up in the aftermath of those failed ideals, and often the ugly aftermath of those failed ideals. And I think that's the complicated thing about guilt. I think it's very possible that you can feel guilty because you've done wrong, but you've done wrong not necessarily because you've chosen to do wrong, but in fact you were trying to do right, and failed to see how those good intentions harmed others.
Right, and that line that keeps ringing, especially throughout the end of the book, the it's not what you do that matters, but what you think. And I always come back to the old proverb of, all it takes for evil to thrive is for good men to stand by and do nothing. Mm-hmm. And those two are at odds. And yet, like you said, there are these times where she tries to do the right thing and she really can't quite get there.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that line's an interesting one. It's repeated. The line comes from a testimony that she overhears when she goes to this church service, essentially. And she repeats the line, it's not what you do, but what you think that matters. And then within the course of that paragraph, it flips and she says, it's not what you think, but what you do that matters. And part of the thing I was thinking about in kind of putting those two lines side by side, and also putting the two plot lines that I explore side by side, is the way in which we can justify either of those statements, right? We can say that it's the doing that matters, and we can say that it's the thinking that matters, and we often tell one story or the other based on our desire not to feel guilty.
I hate to bring the conversation to a grinding halt, but I would love for my audience to hear some of the book, if you don't mind. Yeah. Reading a little bit.
Oh, of course, of course. I'll read from a section, and this is when Linda is a family moves in across the lake from where she lives, and she becomes a babysitter for this family, and that's sort of the beginning of all of the unfolding events that we've talked about. But I wanted to just read the section that introduces that family. I'd seen the couple once before in August. They'd come to oversee the construction of their lake house, which had been built by a team of college students from Duluth. The crew spent the summer clearing brush with backhoes, arranging plywood walls, stapling shingles to the vaulted roof. The house, when it was finished, was unlike anything I'd seen in Loose River. It had split log siding and enormous triangular windows, a broad blonde deck that jutted out over the lake like the prow of some ship. From their hatchback, the father had hauled Adirondack chairs and docile cats, one black and fat, the other white, and draped ornamentally over his arm. I'd seen them out on their new dock one late August afternoon, bundled head to toe in towels, father, mother, tiny child. The child's towel dragged on the wooden planks, and the mother and father had knelt down together at once, arranging the folds. They were like attendants to a very small bride, doting, hovering. They seemed to be saying something very sweet to the child, who had a high, frightened voice that carried across water. That was the last I'd seen of them. That winter day, though, they returned. I saw the father in the evening whisking away at the snow on his deck with a pink broom. Smoke drifted from their chimney. Out came the child and mother the next afternoon, waddling in their boots and snowsuits. The boy moved unsteadily across the fresh crust of snow, walking on the surface of it for a few steps before breaking through. When the mother lifted him up under the armpits, he was plucked clean from his boots. As I watched, the mother dangled the poor kid helplessly aloft, unsure whether to set him down or carry him like that, suspended in socks over a universe of snow. I thought, scornfully, what the hell had they expected? But I felt sorry for them, too. Almost nothing on the lake moved or breathed. It was the worst part of winter, a waste of white in every direction, no place for little kids or city people. Beneath a foot of ice, beneath my boots, the walleye drifted. They did not try to swim or do anything that required effort. They hovered, waiting winter out with driftwood, barely beating their hearts.
Beautiful. The family that Linda observes and then eventually becomes a part of, in a way, what's the word I'm looking for? She sort of stumbles into babysitterdom with them. Yeah. She doesn't really like go up to them and say, "Hey, are you looking for a babysitter?" She observes them from afar, like an anthropologist, and then she sort of falls into their lives. And that was another thing that struck me about Linda, in that she's definitely aware of what's going on. She's not a dumb kid. And yet she is so very trusting about the people around her, even though, especially the male authority figures in her life, with the exception of her father, but Leo, the husband, Mr. Grierson, later on, I think there are a couple of people, but like they're all taking advantage of these younger women and these girls. And yet she's able to see past that and just blindly go on a weekend trip with them to Duluth, or, you know, to get in the car with Mr. Grierson, despite knowing that there's something weird and sinister about him. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, how is she able to reconcile her blind trust of her neighbors and these other people with the clear inappropriateness of the male authority figures around her?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I mean, again, it goes back to her intense loneliness, I think, on some level. She wants so much to be a part of something, particularly this little family that she becomes a part of increasingly by being a babysitter. She sort of insinuates herself without actually actively going up and, you know, asking if they need a babysitter. She does insinuate herself. She stays longer there than they need her to stay, and she goes back when they don't ask her to come. She wants just so badly to be a part of that little world, but I think it's worth saying she wants to be a part of the world that includes, you know, Paul, the boy that she babysits for, and mm-hmm. Patra, the mother, but does feel a certain amount of resistance and even antagonism for Leo, the father. He's gone in the first part of the book, and when he comes back, there's almost this kind of competition between Linda and Leo for Patra, the mother's attention.
Right, like she's built a family with just the three of them, and this interloper has come in.
Right, and and there's a way in which, because of that, I mean, she's allowing herself to go on this trip to Duluth and to spend time with this family, sort of despite her reservations about Leo, but also potentially because of her reservations about Leo. There's that moment, I don't know if you remember, in the hotel room when it's just Linda and Leo, and Leo starts talking about some of his religious beliefs, and she kind of calls him on something that she observed the night before. There was this sexual encounter that she witnessed, and she intentionally makes him feel uncomfortable by reminding him of it, essentially. And this sort of happens, I hope, throughout the book. One of the things I wanted to do with her is to show her not merely as a passive character, but also as one who, you know, who could call figures of authority into question. And so it happens occasionally with characters like Leo, but also somebody like Mr. Grierson. You know, she senses that he has potential interest in the young girls in his class. He's the history teacher. And when he doesn't make a pass at Linda, Linda does that towards him in his direction, right? She reaches out, leans over, and kisses him.
Right.
And he's kind of unsettled by that. And this is another one of those moments in which I just wanted to show her as a figure who's capable of seeing the power that these male figures have, and then potentially using that power against them.
Which is what makes her testimony in the trial so odd. She has no problem calling out these authority figures, and yet when she's put in a position to do such a thing and actually say, "Look, this guy didn't do what he should have done, and I saw everything," she doesn't do it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that scene, you're right. She's sort of planning on blaming everything on Leo, this father figure, the father and the family. And that's her goal. In order to let Patra, the mother, off the hook, then she has that moment in which she encounters Patra in the courtroom parking lot, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember the scene. And Patra essentially lashes out at her in her incredible grief and you know, calls her, treats her like she's the babysitter again, not as a member of the family, and almost blames Linda for what happened. And because she lashes out at Linda, Linda decides that she is not going to protect Patra, and is not, and is going to say that she did nothing. Patra did nothing for her child, to save her child. And so I saw that, you know, there's this moment in which she could have and was planning on revealing the failures of this family, the both the parents, but particularly the father, and decides not to do that, and decides to focus on the mother's failings, her refusal to do anything because the mother lashes out at her. It's her of her revenge. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd like to dive in. It's probably silly now to keep dancing around it since you
but I know, right?
You basically really alluded to what happens. And for anyone who hasn't gotten it yet, spoiler alert, Paul dies. So going on that, Leo, I don't know. I can't remember if you had mentioned exactly what it was, but he's a Christian Scientist.
Yeah, that's right.
And I had heard the term Christian Science before, I think, and Christian Science Monitor. But I never really understood what it was and how it differentiated, how it was different from regular Christianity. And I was wondering, what is the difference between Christian Science and standard Christianity?
Yeah, I mean, the idea behind it is that that we all have the capacity to act and to be like a Christ figure, right? That the ability to perform what we would call miracles is not limited to Jesus. That we're all capable of that, and we're all capable of that because God created a world in which people, in which there's no capacity for evil, sickness, sin, or death. That if God is all good and all powerful, then there can be no room in the universe for sin, sickness, and death. Mm-hmm. And so when we see sin, sickness, and death, it's just a failure to recognize what really is there, which is all good. And if we can sort of align our thinking to what is really there, which is all good and all health and all perfection, essentially, then we will no longer see the sickness that is just an illusion. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And I got that from, especially towards the end when she attends that church service and they talk about how there's that one kid who says, I didn't study for this test. And then I prayed to a certain saint or someone and I ended up doing really well on the test anyway. And I was like, okay, so it's all about if I believe it hard enough, then I can fix whatever is wrong or change whatever is going on.
Yeah, essentially, that's what we're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like infuriated by it because I have a 3-year-old and I was sitting there going, God, why don't you take him to a hospital? But yeah, there I guess there are those people out there who really believe if they pray hard enough, they can change a cancer diagnosis or a pulmonary edema or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. And I was thinking, you know, not just about the idea of belief systems in Christian Science, that was one of the important pieces of the book, but really belief systems more generally, you know, the well-intentioned belief system that sort of organized, that was behind the organization of the commune as well. And just the ways in which we want so badly to believe mm-hmm. That certain things aren't happening right in front of us.
Right, and I think that also goes to Leo as well. He has kind of a a God complex, for lack of a better phrase. He has this very lofty idea of himself and the way he speaks, especially to Linda, that he knows all and he sees all and he's able to do these things.
Yeah, no, it's true. And he's also a teacher, right, and an academic. And so part of it has to do with that. You know, he's always sort of trying to teach the people around him, including his son, including Patra, his wife, and certainly Linda as well. He's a pedant in that way.
Right. I'd like to spin a little bit, and I'd like to talk about the book itself. And specifically in my research before the show, I saw that the first chapter had won a literary prize. And I was wondering how did the book get its start? Did it start with the first chapter winning the prize and then it blossomed into a novel? Or had you always planned on doing a novel and the first chapter was just submitted as a sort of like a test almost?
No, I didn't initially think of this as a novel. It started off as a short story that I wrote when I was living in California. I think I mentioned that early in the program. And it was essentially the first chapter of the book. So I finished that and I submitted it to the Southwest Review. And I thought I was done with this book. I'm sorry, with the story of Linda. And then her voice sort of lingered on in my mind. I had written stories for a long time. I actually thought of myself as a story writer, probably more than a novelist, for the vast majority of my writing career. And I kept trying to write novels, and they kept collapsing back into stories. And that's okay. I actually love stories. I think I love reading them. I love writing them. But this particular story, there was something resonant about the voice of Linda that just lingered in my mind. And so when I finished it, the story, I knew I wanted to write about some bigger issues, especially related to Christian Science. But I wasn't sure how to go about that. And I kept hearing Linda's voice, and I thought she might be an interesting perspective to take on these events. Her voice was vivid to me. It was peculiar enough for me to remain interested in for the long time it takes to write a novel. You know, even a short novel like this takes years, and I needed to not get bored with the voice, and she never bored me. And the place was really vivid. We talked about that earlier as well. So that I felt like in that first story, I had two pieces that were really essential to writing a longer work, the place and the voice. So I just kind of went back to them, and I found it really interesting. That first story, you know, is largely about her teacher, who is accused of sex crimes and pedophilia. And I was thinking a lot about the relationship of thought to action, even in that first story. And I thought, okay, that theme in that context could be interesting to set beside that same theme in a totally different context. Mm-hmm. In the sort of religious context, and just sort of look at what resonates between the two, and also contrasts between the two, and how these two different plots can kind of reveal more about the other when set side by side. So that's kind of how I ended up thinking of it. And the story finished, and then I just felt like there was more I could do with it.
What was it about Christian Science that captivated you enough to include it as a large part of the story?
I actually spent some time very intimately with Christian Scientists a long time ago when I was younger. So that kind of remained in my mind. And also, like I said before, as a writer, I'm really interested in questions of perception and also questions of storytelling. And I think of religion as a story that people tell. Mm-hmm. About the way the world works. And a way to explain the world is through the sort of set of religious stories. And so I wanted to do that. I wanted to think about storytelling kind of through the lens of religious philosophy, and to think about the ways in which we project the stories that we choose onto the people around us, and how harmful that can be. There's a moment late in the book that Linda sort of says, you know, the story I'm trying to tell here is one about the origin of human evil, because her friend essentially says, you know, Christian Science is an account for evil. So how do you talk about a world without evil? And What Linda is suggesting there, as far as I understand her, is that, you know, it's the storytelling that we do that can be the source of evil. That the things that we say about the world, if they occlude or fail to take in the needs of others, the desperate needs of others, those stories can be incredibly harmful and incredibly dangerous. And so that the larger question I had, sort of beyond Christian Science, was one about storytelling.
How long had you worked on the book before you had secured an agent?
That's a good question. I worked on it for a couple years, probably about, I want to say, 2 or 3, 2 and a half. I wrote the story and then I put it aside for a little while. I was going to school at the time. I was in this wonderful hybrid PhD program in which we did creative writing and also critical research. And so I was writing about literature. And so I had my critical project to work on as well. And so I put away the creative work for a time, and then came back to it and finished a version of the novel. And once I finished that version, I sent it to an agent. So it must have been about 2 or 2.5 years.
You're a podcaster and blogger. You need an analytics and hosting platform that provides you with the right tools to make your job easier, so you can get back to doing what you do best, creating stuff. FeedPress is a delightfully intuitive RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform with accurate analytics for RSS feeds and email newsletters. Bloggers and podcasters can tap into RSS subscriber, geolocation, podcast download, and link tracking metrics, which come standard on all plans. In a matter of minutes, podcasters can create a feed and publish it to iTunes. Add your show notes, artwork, and drag and drop an MP3 into the editor to go live. Every podcast plan comes with 400 megabytes of file storage that's unmetered. This means you won't have to worry about running out of storage for long episodes or getting dinged for a sudden spike in download traffic when your podcast becomes an overnight success. FeedPress offers an automatic feed burner migration tool so you can make that transition with ease. Your feeds and subscriber data will be moved into your FeedPress account. And if you're currently hosting a podcast elsewhere, they can help you migrate your feeds and media files over so that your listeners don't notice you've changed anything. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via email. Sign up today and try FeedPress on a 14-day commitment-free trial. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year.
And you were at Cornell, right?
No, I teach at Cornell.
Teach at Cornell? Because I know in the biography on the website for Cornell, it says that you had been... So you were teaching while you were editing the book.
That's right.
At Cornell. And I am curious because it's something that comes up a lot with fellow writers is the balance, the work-life balance between working on your creative stuff and your free time and any time you have, and at the same time balancing, you know, what pays the bills. So what was it like teaching creative writing and teaching at Cornell and then editing this book for publication?
Yeah. Good question. So, you know, I did an MFA, a number of years ago, and then I did a lot of other things, mostly teaching. I taught in China. I did adjunct work all over, and that I found those years of adjuncting, that was the hardest period to work on writing, honestly, because so much teaching was required to make a living. Mm-hmm. I ended up going back to get my PhD in part because I just think it ended up being a wonderful way to write and get paid for it, honestly. I was reading books and writing while I was in school for the years I was getting my PhD, and it was just a wonderful work-life balance. I would go back and do it again in an instant if I had a chance to, because for me, and this wouldn't be true for all writers, the program I was at USC, the University of Southern California, they require quite a lot of critical research. I had to do essentially half of a dissertation, so quite a lot of writing about writing, and not all writers want to do that with their time. But for me, it was ideal because it got me thinking about Dickens and Wolfe, and I, you know, got thinking about plot and narrative theory and wonderful things that were super helpful for me as a writer. So that was probably the best moment. When I finished that, I began teaching again and did so at Cornell. I had a postdoc at Cornell, so that was very lovely. They don't require that much teaching, and the idea is that I would continue to work on my own stuff. So I was very grateful for that opportunity, and it was really important because while I was teaching, I had a lot of revisions on this book to do. And that's one thing that I guess I would say is I didn't expect once I submitted the book to the agent, my wonderful agent, Nicole Raji, and then once it was accepted for publication, there were several rounds of revisions and edits, and that took a lot more time than I expected. Those several rounds of reworking the book.
And I would think you're in getting your PhD, you probably picked up some wonderful research skills as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure. Research. Although I will say there's sort of one way of using one's brain and another way of using one's brain. And when I was doing my critical research, I was writing about the most nerdy subject possible. I was writing about simultaneity in narratives by women. So essentially fiction writers, female fiction writers. Mm-hmm. And so I was writing about this really sort of complicated technical subject, sort of the way that plotting worked and timing in books. And I loved doing that work. But when I left it and I needed to work on the novel, I sort of needed to think in an entirely different way, right? That part of my brain that was thinking critically, it wasn't that I had to turn off the critical part of my brain, but I needed to play a little bit more and experiment. Mm-hmm. It always, felt like trying things out and making a mess. You're playing is the best word I can think of, in a way that writing critically doesn't feel, for me at least. Writing critically felt more like math, honestly.
Like there's a formula to it.
Maybe a formula, not so much a formula, but like working on a logic problem.
Okay.
I want to study this book by Virginia Woolf. I want to think about how she is depicting the way that two events happen at the same time within a linear narrative, right? So then I have to, count the number of pages that she uses on a particular scene, et cetera, right? That kind of really technical thinking that I don't want to use as a writer so much, except for maybe in edits and revision. As a writer, it's a lot more about instinct. Where do I feel right. like I should go next? I don't know why. I don't want to think too hard about why yet I feel like we should go in this direction. I want to feel it out. And then only later kind of go back and justify it to myself. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. It sounds like writing critically is more like almost like conducting a study. Like you've got this idea and now I need to conduct this experiment and pick this thing apart to see if it's true.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You have this theory, but you're not sure whether or not it's working the way that you think that it's working. And right. then you kind of go back and you examine the evidence. No, absolutely. Yeah. Like an experiment. That's a great way of putting it. Certainly creative writing is an experiment too, but it's like less that you have the theory at first. It's more like you're just trying things out and you don't know what the ultimate conclusion will be. You have no idea. You don't have a theory until after you finish. And then you sort of look back at what you've already written and begin to see what it all adds up to.
Yes. Well, I'm a pantser, not a plotter. So when I write a book, it's very much like, oh, what does this button do? And then watch it blow up.
yeah, exactly. And sometimes you're like, oh God, that's a terrible idea. I need to like not do that and cut that and get rid of it. Right.
Right.
But other times you're like, that was brilliant. Like I wouldn't have tried that if I had worked on this book logically through a kind of more formulaic way of thinking.
Right, right. And this book also won you a grant as well, right, for feminist fiction?
Yeah, I did. I was in the process of writing it. I submitted the first part of it and got some money. Yes, a little bit of money, which was wonderful, super helpful again, to make the writing possible during a summer. One summer I was able to work on it, and not have to go find a teaching gig. I think that's fabulous to have that out there, the support, especially of women writers.
What are the expectations of getting something like that? Do they want to see the published book? Do they just want to see a book at the end of it?
I think I had to write a proposal, and I suggested that I would write a book. They didn't ask to see the book at the end. I think they do ask that, you know, you give them some credit.
Okay.
It's the Barbara Deming Memorial Fund. And so of course I was happy to thank them in my acknowledgments at the end of the book. It's one of those things as a writer, you know, I'm always, especially when I was a student and before when I was, you know, teaching as an adjunct instructor, I was always kind of on the lookout for funding, because it can be really hard to find the time to write, to have that time funded.
I've heard of some people getting things like fellowships, and they're asked to submit work during the fellowship as proof that, you know, they're using the time wisely. Mm-hmm. So I was just interested in wondering what was asked of you in exchange for the money. I assume if someone's giving you money, they want something in return.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I think I'd have to actually go back and look. And it was a long time ago now, but I'm pretty sure that the idea was that they, you know, that you hopefully you live up to what you said you do in your proposal, which is to finish a book. And luckily, I did do that. I'm not sure if you get punished if you didn't do that. I don't know what that would mean. I don't know if they can take the money back or not. I have no idea. It's a little like a residency, though. I don't know if you have you had the chance to go and do a residency.
I have not. No.
It's also one wonderful way to have some time to write. So you write a proposal and you give a little excerpt of your work and you go and live somewhere for a while. And I mean, at a residency, the idea is that you do what you said that you were going to do, but it's okay if you end up doing something really different. You know, I don't think anyone's going to take the time back. I think that's impossible.
I'd like to go a little bit back to the editing process, because you said there was the edits were extensive. What was it like once you submitted the book to the agent? Did Nicola Raggi have a lot of edits for you, and then you would just go back and forth like that, or did most of the edits come from the editor at the publishing house?
Yeah, when I say there were a lot of edits, I think I mean more that there were a lot of rounds of edits.
Right, right.
So I was told as a writer, and to be clear, I wrote this book without really thinking about publication. I think if I had thought about publication, I'm not sure I would have written it. I was mostly just writing it to think through some things that were fascinating and interesting to me. And I think I would have been probably too scared in a lot of ways to write this book if I had thought very hard about publication. Once I finished it, that's when I started thinking more about publication, and it was always just one step at a time. Like I sort of told myself I would just submit it, you know, to the agent. I just submit it and see what happened. Right. And once, you know, Nicole looked at it, she didn't have a lot of changes, just a few little tweaks here and there, that I took mostly. And then she submitted it to publishers. And again, I just told myself, okay, we'll go one step at a time, you know, maybe no publishers will want it. And I felt very, very lucky that Grove Atlantic wanted it. Elizabeth Schmitz was my editor there. She is fantastic. And Nicole asked me from the beginning, you know, who would you want to work with if you could choose anyone to work with out in the publishing world. And Elizabeth was one of the people I said I would love to work with even before she made an offer, because she's just such a fantastic editor. Luckily she wanted the book. And she's a very light touch as an editor. So she's very gentle. She offered suggestions in pencil, you know, on the side. and we had some conversations. I'm the kind of writer that I write from sentence to sentence. And so, when I finished the book, I felt done with it. And the sentences felt like they were kind of all in place. And so whenever anyone went in and said, okay, why don't you reword this or rewrite this? It felt kind of like a major a major intervention to me, because I felt so committed in a way to the rhythm of my sentences and the way they sounded in my own ear. And so it was always hard to make changes based on content after the sentences were in place. But Elizabeth gave me some suggestions, and then I thought I was done, you know. And I then had a second read from another editor, her assistant editor, and that I didn't expect and didn't know about. And that was, so again, I had to go back, and then there was the copy editor, and she made fairly extensive sets of changes, and that I didn't expect. I didn't expect such extensive suggestions. And then there were many rounds of proofs, and those also included suggestions for change. And so each time I thought I was done, I wasn't done, right? And again, because I'm the kind of writer I am, it wasn't ever easy for me to make those changes, and it was never easy for me to not make those changes either. I felt like I had to think through each one, and when I decided not to take every suggestion, I had to defend it and say why. And so that work, even if the final manuscript wasn't very different from the initial one, I always felt like it required a lot of work for me to decide that it wasn't going to change very much, if you know what I mean.
Was there any point where you were like, this doesn't feel like my book anymore?
No, but I think, you know, and this might come up later in our conversation when you ask me about publishing tips or my thoughts about the publishing world. I think one of the things I learned was that standing your ground as a writer is as important as sort of listening to and hearing out all the suggestions for change. I tried to first, you know, give all the suggestions a benefit of the doubt. I tried them all out and looked at them very carefully. But oftentimes I would go back, I'd revert back to my initial thought or initial idea. And one could say that maybe that was just me being stubborn, which maybe I was. But also I felt like I had to live with the book when it was published. And that was sort of the litmus test is, you know, will I regret this change later when I look at this book?
Right.
And sometimes that meant preserving what even might be perceived as a flaw or something that's problematic, because I felt like I was taking a risk to do something interesting. That, and if I made the change and made the book more familiar or more similar to other books, I would feel less good about it, less excited by it as a writer. And so there was a long process of sort of learning how to defend the things that I did that might have seemed unusual or, you know, that editors hadn't maybe seen before in just that way.
Well, the final product was phenomenal. And you're absolutely right. There is a rhythm to this book. While reading it, I didn't really notice it at first, but now thinking back on it, it does. There is a cadence to it. The book itself has a voice, and it's absolutely wonderful.
Oh, I'm so glad you could hear that. Like I said, I probably think in sentences first and the sound of sentences first. So that's always kind of what I go back to as a writer.
Since this season is all about women authors, I'm curious, are you reading any books by women authors right now?
Let's see. I just had the chance to read a really fabulous book. I'm going to make a plug for a book called Red Clocks by Leni Zumas. And it's coming out, I think, in a few months or so. But I got to read an earlier version of it, and it's amazing. It's a beautiful book about female experience in this sort of slightly ulterior reality. It's a little bit of a dystopian world, but not very dystopian.
I'm reading the description on Amazon, and it's actually not far off from where we're headed.
Exactly. I highly recommend it. It's a beautiful book. It's just these sparkling, bristling, beautiful sentences. So I recommend that. I'm just now listening to Allie Smith's book, Autumn. I just had a new baby, and so I'm actually not able to hold a book very much. I'm often nursing and need to like use both hands. Mm. So I'm listening to books while I nurse, and I listen to Allie Smith's Autumn. She's another one of the Booker shortlisted authors, and that's beautiful. Oh, it's just a gorgeous book. So I recommend that one as well.
I meant to ask you, what was it like the first time you saw your book was both longlisted and then shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize?
It's sort of a funny story. I was giving birth. I was in the hospital when I found out the book was longlisted for the Booker Prize. So my agent and my UK editor were trying to contact me, but I just assumed that it was not very important, whatever they wanted. And I was in labor, so I didn't get back with them for a while. And by the time I got their emails, they essentially decided that they couldn't wait to talk to me, and they sent the news via email. And I really thought that I was misreading the email. Like, it just didn't make any sense. I thought I must miss. I was sleep deprived, and I assumed that I didn't understand what I was reading. So it was completely unexpected, incredibly humbling. When I saw the other writers on the long list, they're writers I've revered for my entire writing career. Allie Smith, Paul Auster, George Saunders, these are just such talented writers. And so I felt just so delighted and humbled to even see my name anywhere near theirs. So the fact that I'm near, Autumn on Amazon is thrilling and so, so, so humbling.
Fantastic books listed, although I was disheartened to read that your agency brother, Colson Whitehead, was not listed as for Underground Railroad. He was not listed as one of the Man Booker nominees. I was very disappointed.
I loved that book too. It has deserved all of the praise it's gotten, and it is, I think, a really important book. I agree with you. It's one of the books that I would highly recommend for any reader to take on.
Definitely. Emily, thank you so much. This is absolutely wonderful.
Oh my gosh, thank you. It was really fun talking to you.
Where can people find you?
Where can they find me?
Online, not in real life.
I was going to say, I am actually not much of an online person. I don't have a Twitter handle or anything like that.
It was difficult to get a hold of you to get in touch.
I'm very old school, very old fashioned in that way.
I'm actually a little jealous.
And I do covet my privacy, but definitely, I do have a website, Emily Fridland Books. So all my readings are on the website, so you can find me there. All of my readings and appearances are on Grove Atlantic's website. So if you go look for me there, on my publisher's website, I'm there as well. And I'm still at Cornell, so I'm available through them as well.
Great. And I will put links to everything in the show notes. This has been Covered with special guest Emily Fridland. Links to History of Wolves and all other books discussed will be available in our show notes and on our website at hologramradio.org/covered. I'd like to thank our Patreon patrons, Brad Dowdy, Vaughn Johnson, Chris Jones, Tim Wassum, Stuart Lennon, Kyle Wallace, Alex Knight, and Aaron Mankey. If you're able to give a dollar or two an episode to help fund more great interviews like this one today, please consider supporting Covered at patreon.com/covered. And actually, this episode should be launching on October 13th, and Patreon patron Aaron Mankey's new show, Lore, will be debuting on Amazon. So do be sure to check that out as well. He's a good friend, and he's a friend of the show, and we are very proud of him. In addition to helping me make the show by donating to Patreon, you will also gain access to ad-free versions of these episodes, as well as a bonus mini episode at the $5 level. And if you fancy other Hologram Radio shows and would like to drop a few dollars their way, you can support the network as a whole at patreon.com/hologramradio. You can follow me on Twitter at HCMarks and the show at Covered_FM. Thank you to TJ Cosgrove for our beautiful logo and Lorenzo Gudemi for all the hard work he puts into making this show sound fantastic. And as always, thank you again to Feed Press and Noct Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.